Bulimia sucks, but you don't, and here's why. The Bulimia Sucks podcast with Kate Hudson Hall will teach you how to begin breaking through the multitude of thoughts, feelings, triggers, and urges to empower yourself to change your painful behaviors completely. You will hear proven strategies and solutions to help you in your recovery, including real interviews with real people. Kate has just released a new best-selling book called Anxiety Hacks, with proven techniques, tools, and tips to calmness. Check it out now on Amazon. And now, another episode of Bulimia Sucks, the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Bulimia Sucks. I'm your host, Kate Hudson Hall, and thank you so much for listening. Now, this is a platform for people to share relatable, uplifting, and inspiring conversations based on an eating disorder. And episodes include talking with professionals who work with people with an eating disorder, who may have had their own struggles with some sort of eating disorder, and also to people who work with people with eating disorders. And so as a therapist, I've created a free Bulimia Sucks course to help you get started on your recovery pathway. So if you would be interested to find out more about that, if you go to my website, katehudson-hall.com, and I have a sign-up form on the homepage, so that will take you straight into the course. And I have just finished my book on help for people with anxiety. So that's just gone off to the editor, so I'm waiting for that to come back, and who knows what she'll say. So that will be interesting. Now, our guest today, I'm very excited, is Anthea McCartan. Now, she's a qualified therapeutic counsellor, motivational speaker, and she volunteers for a new charity called Mental Health Motorbike. And also, which is really exciting, she's written a book. Now, her book is called A Personal Account of How Childhood Sexual Abuse Almost Stole Her Sanity and How She Overcame the Past. Due to her past childhood sexual abuse, in her 30s, she had a breakdown, which resulted in her suffering from anorexia. In ways to help her cope in dealing with the pain and the trauma that she was experiencing at the time. And it was the only way that she could find some control to distract her from the darkest parts of herself and the shame being at the core of the breakdown. So her book, A Personal Account of How Childhood Sexual Abuse Almost Stole Her Sanity and How She Overcame the Past, recounts the abuse at the hand of a family member, her grandfather, and the years of shame and depression afterwards, and how she fought back to not only survive, but to thrive. Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that, Anthea. So welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's an honour, a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yay. No, it's great to have you on. So, Anthea, do you have a funny story for us?
I do. Yeah, when you asked me for a funny story, the first one that came to mind was my nickname is Mayo. We have a private messenger group, me and my motorcycle pals. And yeah, my nickname on there is Mayo because of this story. So I was away with a friend of mine. We was at Motorcycle Live in Birmingham with Mental Health Motorbike. And we'd been at the show all day. We were absolutely shattered, and we went back to the hotel, ordered ourselves a pizza, and saw a group of guys there who were also motorcyclists and had been at the show. And they was like, yeah, because the hotel was packed. So I said, yeah, come and sit with us. So we sat there and pizza arrived, got those small sachets of mayonnaise, and I tried to tear it open, and sometimes I can be a real pain, can't they?
Yeah, open the sachet.
So I've managed to tear a small hole and thought that would be enough. Squeeze the sachet, and instead of the mayonnaise going on my plate, it went on this new guy that we just met, and it landed on his trousers in a very precarious position. And I just went, oh, hi, my name's Anthea. It was a great introduction, broke the ice. He was really good about it though, but we just laughed for ages after that. So yeah, that's funny, embarrassing. Yeah, that's so now I'm called Mayo.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. Oh my gosh. So how embarrassing.
It really was, yeah. I'm blushing now just thinking about it.
Oh gosh. So Anthea, so you had anorexia. Tell us about how, you know, how you, why you feel that sort of took a hold.
Well, I have been living with the trauma without realizing that I've been living in the trauma. I had no idea about, I had no level of awareness. I had no idea about the ripple effects and consequences of childhood sexual abuse. And I just carried on living my life, trying to be perfect, the perfect daughter, perfect wife, perfect mother. And I think I was suppressing everything and yet still felt as though I had no control over my life. It didn't matter how hard I worked at being perfect, everything, I just felt so powerless and helpless and just desperate to try and find and maintain some control in my life, because everything else felt so confusing and topsy-turvy. So it got to the point where my mental health was declining rapidly, and it was a very frightening experience, and it was really escalating to something huge. And I wanted a way out.
Right.
I was contemplating suicide, but avenues that I was exploring seemed frightening to me, and I didn't want to die either. It's not that I wanted my life to end. You know, I had a wonderful husband, two lovely children, and I was trying to hold on to that, but and yet that darkness was just so overwhelming. I needed a way out, and like I said to you, the control element as well. And I just stopped eating. So for me, it wasn't so much about image. It was about finding control over something that was made no sense to me.
Yeah.
I needed some control in my life. And because of my insecurities, a result of the abuse, I'd always been very self-conscious about my body. And although it doesn't sound logical to maybe the listener, to me it made sense to just stop eating. And for a time, I wouldn't say I felt better, but I felt like I was gaining some control back.
You had something like you could control in your life.
Yes, I felt like, right, okay, I can't control anything about the way I'm feeling about myself, what I'm thinking about and believing about myself, but I had this thing that I was in control of, and it was just hanging by a piece of thread, but it was enough to keep me going with that perfect wife, perfect mom, and it got to the point where I couldn't cope anymore, because obviously I was so weak and battling with the inner demons. That we moved in, my husband and I and the children, because our children were small. I think my son was about six, seven, probably six, because my daughter hadn't yet started school. So we moved in with my husband's parents, and they helped to look after all of us, really, because right. I couldn't function anymore. Yeah.
And what was the... What was the moment that you decided, okay, I really have got to, you know, do take a small step onto that recovery path?
That was actually quite a bit further down the line. I had a breakdown, tried to take my own life by jumping out of a bedroom window. And that was while we were living with my husband's parents and my mother-in-law had just taken the children to school and came back and found me there and called the doctor immediately. And I was admitted into hospital and did a 4-month stint on a mental health ward. where there was a lot of intervention, as you can imagine, with psychiatric help, counselling and talking therapy and everything. And also had ECT.
Right.
Compulsive therapy, which is extreme therapy.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
They really don't like to do now.
Yeah.
That I was so suicidal and I wasn't really present in the present, in the here and now. And they just couldn't do anything with me. And I was always attempting to take my own life. It was a very, very dark chapter of my life, very dark. But once those interventions were put in place, slowly, very slowly started to eat, because obviously they were monitoring my food as well. As they began to, it's funny actually, well, not funny, but the day I was admitted into hospital, it was a team of psychotherapists, mental health nurses, and my husband in a room, and they asked me, "What do you think brought you here today?" And I reeled off life events that had been going on. We've been in a really serious car accident in Austria. I'd just made my best friend's wedding cake. We just moved, and just listing off things like that. And I was completely oblivious to trauma. I'd never really heard the word trauma uttered at that point. I had no idea about the consequences of sexual abuse. Mm. And they said, "Well, yes, these are all triggers. These can trigger what's brought you here today, but is there something else?" They were really pushing to see if there was anything else. And I shrugged my shoulder. Went, well, I was so flippant about it. I just said, well, I was abused as a kid. And that was my level of awareness at the time.
Yeah, no, I could totally relate to that, because I was abused when I was 9. And I didn't ever talk to anybody about it until I was in my 30s when I was having therapy. I just buried it away. And that did have a large part of why I had bulimia and anorexia.
Yeah, that's really relatable. Yeah, that's pretty much where I was at, because I was 30 and I had no idea.
Yeah.
I think this is why it's so important as well, isn't it, to keep talking about this. And it's a very difficult topic and people don't want to hear about it, but we actually went through that. And I think that's why it's so, so important to just keep talking and raising that awareness, because I believe there are still many victim survivors out there that are living with this shame and silence.
Yes.
And living with the trauma without even realising it. And I think the more we keep talking about it and saying, this is what it was like for us, and drawing that picture, people will be able to resonate with that, won't they?
Yes.
We need to make our experiences relatable to others.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So they can sort of begin to feel a bit more confident about reaching out for help.
And not so alone and isolated, yeah.
Yeah, because that's what it feels like. It just feels like, you know, you've done wrong and it's so shameful and you're disgusting and everything else that goes with it.
Yeah, and it's such a confusing time and none of it makes sense until you start hearing other people's stories, or you're in therapy and the therapist is saying to you, well, this is actually quite normal. You know, when the psychotherapists were normalising all my thoughts, feelings and behaviours around the trauma, it was quite a freeing experience. That's normal. You know, even with me stopping eating and them saying, well, actually, this is quite normal, this is quite common, we come across this all the time. It began to release that heavy load of shame that I was carrying, and that really helped with the healing,
the
normalising of it. Mm.
Yeah. And you were in hospital for 4 months, and then I presume when you came out, then you continued having psychotherapy. Yes.
Yeah. Like I say, it was a very long road. So the first stint I did was 4 months, and then for a further 4 years, I was in and out of hospital, because it's like the roller coaster, isn't it? You know, I'd get better and then there'd be another trigger. And it would set me back again.
Yeah.
And I'd be readmitted back into hospital. And it was like that for 4 years, just up and down like a yo-yo. But each time I was still getting better. There was more hope, glimmer of light. But yeah, that was 4 years. Yeah, 4 years of recovery, intense recovery, intense work.
Oh gosh. And then we have life experiences that go on top of that at the time we're trying to work through our our difficulties.
Trying to hold on to life, just life, you know, being like we were saying, being a wife, being a mum, working, and trying to shield the children as much as we could from what was going on. That was really hard, and to a degree it wasn't manageable. It was impossible to shield them completely from what was going on. But yeah, holding on to life was very hard. Still living with that shame for those 4 years.
And I think, sorry, Anthea, I think as well for me, my boundaries were in a way distorted.
Yeah.
And when I got to 18, I remember I went to this party and I drank too much because I didn't drink. And it was whiskey, and I never touch whiskey now because of that night. And I remember, I don't remember collapsing, but I remember waking up on a bed in this house, in this party, being raped by, I know there was three of them there and they were all taking it in turns. And you think, you know, I don't know, my boundaries were distorted completely, and that went on. And then another experience happened as well further down the line that, you know, was a very difficult time. And so, you know, all the more reason why it's so important to talk about what happened in the past, so you can sort of align your boundaries and get your, you know, start to understand yourself more.
Yeah, you've raised something so important there. So often childhood victims of abuse are re-victimised later on in life. And like yourself, that happened to me as well. It was on one of my weekends. We were, I was at a family party, so I thought that I'd be safe. It was a barbecue. And I was still heavily dosed up on medication and drunk alcohol, and it just knocked me out. And I was meant to be going home with my husband, but he thought I was safe there. He left me there. And I was put to bed, and I woke up with two people trying to rape me. Yeah. And there was just something in me that just the fear of no, not again. And I just screamed. And the one individual, because they came up one at a time. So one had come upstairs and tried, and then the other one. So I think they were in cahoots about it. And when the other one came up, I screamed, and my sister came running up the stairs, and this the one that was trying to rape me acted all innocent. Oh, I don't know what's wrong. I was just going to the toilet, and she's just screaming in the bedroom. But like you were saying, it's about the boundaries. My boundaries were still very broken, and they noticed that. And one of the individuals knew me. The other one was a friend of one of the individuals. So he knew my history, he knew about my grandfather, he knew about my past, so he really did know about my vulnerability and my broken boundaries. And I did report them to the police the following day, because I, with what had happened to me in my childhood, I was just, no, I just can't allow this, you know. I think I was beginning to slowly find some sense of self-worth, and desperate to put those boundaries in place. Although they weren't there, I was desperate to put them in place because I didn't want this happening anymore. Yeah, really important.
And you work a lot now with people with that to help them overcome different traumas. So what how do you work with them and sort of guide them towards opening up to their boundaries?
Yeah, so I run a charity for 5 years, and I run a lot of workshops on this very topic, how your boundaries are broken. We looked at the broken boundaries first to help the victim survivors understand why their boundaries are broken, and why they feel unable to say no to people. You know, that was one of my opening questions. Do you find it, not just about sexual abuse, but just boundaries in general, yeah, do you find it difficult to say no to anything, you know, whether it's going to the party or going out for a coffee somewhere?
If yes, when you don't want to do it.
And you just don't want to. Do you find it difficult to say no? And we really broke that down and just started to look at why we find it difficult to say no, because I was exactly the same. You know, we'd perhaps, there'd be a family event being arranged and, you know, people were very assertive and they'd say, well, I want to meet at such time and I want to eat there, and I'd just be a very yes sir, no sir, three bags full. So I'd just, as long as everybody else was happy, you know, I'd just fall into place, even if I didn't want to meet at that time or I didn't want to eat at that particular destination. So it's just back to basics, you know, and that's how I work to begin with within those workshops. And then when the victim survivors begin to feel ready, then we start going a little deeper, deeper levels, and looking at the vulnerability. So for me, my grandfather noticed the vulnerability within me because I was just 2.5 when my twin sisters were born. And before they were born, I was the only child, obviously, and had my parents all to myself. I felt as a toddler very safe and secure in that, the centre of their world, you know, because I know you're a qualified counsellor. So as children, just by nature, we're egotistical, and that's very normal, and that's yeah, fine, yeah, you know. And then when my twin sisters came along with these cute ginger curls, and they were the centre of attention, then all of a sudden I felt sidelined.
Yeah.
And I think my grandfather noticed that, you know, because we're talking about vulnerabilities here, aren't we? And he noticed that, and that's where the abuse occurred. So within the workshops, we start looking at the broken boundaries and vulnerabilities because we're trying to remove that shame, aren't we? Because to begin with, we own it. Somehow I must have a label, abuse me, use me. And just trying to remove those labels that we're owning that don't belong to us. They're not us, but just removing those labels. So yeah, that's a lot of the work we do. How can we remove those labels? How can we shift the blame? How can we start putting those boundaries in place that were never there to start with? And
and starting to believe that you're worthy of living your life how you want to.
Absolutely, yeah. It's all about, because we don't believe that we're worthy of love. We don't believe that we're worthy of that safety. And we need to start building that self-love, self-confidence, self-worth. And that's a lot of the work that I've been doing in workshops. And even in public speak, when I do my public talks, motivational speaking, that's a lot of the work that I do, you know, from shifting from being disempowered to empowered.
Nice, love it. Yeah. So Anthea, so what do you feel was the hardest part of your recovery journey?
The hardest part was looking at myself,
turning inward.
Yeah, it really was. I was only talking to somebody yesterday about, because my dad, he used to be a TV engineer. And back in the 80s, he had one of these really big video cameras, and all our family outings were recorded, and Christmases and things, you know, and I used to watch them and feel irritated. You know, we're talking about inner child work here, you know, and I used to feel quite irritated. I couldn't watch the videos comfortably. I could watch my parents and my siblings and my nan and be fine with that, but as soon as I started to look at myself in those videos, I just wanted to look away, and I was recoiling and cringing, and because she reflected that the little Anthea was like looking in a mirror, and I could see all the brokenness, and I could see all the shame. I could see everything that I didn't like about myself, so I was unable to watch them. And then when I began the intense work of trauma and was working on self-love, once that shame was removed, you know, and building my confidence and creating a new me, there was a moment when I was watching the video. It was whilst I was writing the book, actually, because obviously recalling things for the book, I needed to dates and events, you know, so I wanted to get it all accurate. So I was watching the videos again, and I was 40s when I was doing that. So I'd already had the breakdown, 4 years in and out of hospital, and I'd qualified as a counsellor. So, and as you know, when you're qualifying as a counsellor, there's a lot of self-awareness work there. So I thought I'd done, you know, I was patting myself on the back. I've done really good. I've come a long way. I feel healed. I feel recovered. This is amazing. And then I was watching a video one day of myself and my family. We was at a park with my nan, and I was doing cartwheels and watch me, daddy, trying to get that attention and that affirmation that I was so desperate for back then.
Yeah.
Watch me, daddy. And whereas before I'd look away and I was cringing, I just burst into tears.
Mm.
And for the first time, I felt empathy for that little girl. And I just wanted to scoop her up and give her a hug and just tell her that everything was going to be okay. So that was a real poignant moment. It was a real shift, even though, like I said, that's 8 years in total, really, with the therapy and then the counseling training. But that moment was, it was a huge shift. It just, yeah, brought about a huge shift in me. And it was like, oh, wow, it was all that criteria that I'd covered throughout my training. And I actually felt that was a real, I get it, the inner child.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It was like, I get it now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, gosh.
But yeah, that was the hardest.
So, Andrea, what advice would you give somebody that maybe has had a trauma and that has an eating disorder?
Don't feel ashamed of what you're living. Don't be ashamed of what you're going through. Don't be ashamed of where you're at. Validate it. I think that's really important, to allow yourself this space rather than berate yourself for it. Validate it. And because I think once we accept what we're going through and where it comes from, it's easier to begin that path of recovery, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's validating it, accepting it, acknowledging it, and not feeling shame.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
And so your book, so it came out, so this year it came out.
Yeah.
And so it's your memoir of that experience with your grandfather.
Yeah.
And then how your eating disorder developed. And
I speak about the anorexia and the weight loss. And then I speak about the trauma that I was experiencing, and just finding out what was wrong with me. I write about that quite a bit because I had no idea, like we were saying earlier in your podcast, I just didn't know what was going on in my life. And so I write about that, write about looking inwards and the self-awareness work that I had to do in order to find that healing, how painful it was. So you really are, I was really covering the ripple effects of the abuse, the consequences of the abuse on me and my personality, how it shaped me, how it defined me. And one of my quotes that I came across, my favourite quotes when I was doing my studies, was Carl Jung. I am not what has happened to me, and who I choose to become. It's one of my favourites.
Yeah.
So I'll then talk about how I shifted from being fixated on, I wonder who I might have been if I hadn't been abused, to actually, I've been abused, I accept that, but now I can create who I want to be. So that's all in the book. Yeah, and how I went about creating the new me, who I wanted to be.
Wow, what a journey.
An exciting journey, yeah.
Yeah. And so, as I said in the beginning, Anthea's book is called A Personal Account of How Childhood Sexual Abuse Almost Stole Her Sanity and how she overcame her past. So that's available on Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon, yeah, Kindle Unlimited. You can download a free sample because this is about keeping victim survivors safe. So you can download a free sample and see if it is the book for you. If you do download it and you do read it, I'd say tell somebody that if you haven't begun that road of healing, then tell somebody that you're reading it and that you might need to ring them up and talk with them. Just keep yourself safe while you read it. Yeah.
And are there any specific resources that really helped you in your recovery?
The resources that really helped me began when I was doing my counselling training. The Road Less Travelled was a brilliant book, and Homecoming was another one. Those two books, like if you feel that you're ready to start self-awareness work, because it's very hard, as you know, it's very, very hard, because you really are looking at the deepest, darkest parts of self as well as the other parts. And if you feel you're ready, then buy those books and, perhaps do it with a therapist, but because we had our tutors, didn't we, in counselling when we were doing that work. Really good books.
Yeah.
I'd say life-changing for me.
Yeah. Oh, good. So everybody needs to check those out.
Yeah.
And so what are you doing now? So you're working as a counsellor.
Yeah, I'm, not as a one-to-one. I did for a time, I had my own private practice for a year, but I found that because of not really being able to disclose too much about yourself within that setting, I felt restricted and boxed and hemmed in, and I felt like this is not right for me. And actually my husband and I had a conversation because I felt, because he financed my training, and I said to him, this isn't right for me working as a counsellor. And I shared with him why, because I said, I've got this story and I'm unable to share it. So I set up a charity and run that for 5 years. And now I'm volunteering for Mental Health Motorbike. I do public speaking, motivational speaking, workshops live online on Instagram. So I'm always working at getting that awareness out there. I'm always speaking, always talking, because my goal is that victim survivors do not feel alone and isolated, and it's being a voice for them whilst they're still trying to find theirs.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's so interesting, isn't it? It was you turning inwards again and going, well, actually, I've done all this training now. It's not working for me doing one-to-one. So how can I, how can I turn that around? How can I, help others in a different way?
But still utilising those skills. That's it. I still wanted to utilise those skills. And one of the things my husband said to me when I braved, broaching the subject with him, he said he didn't see it as a waste of money because he saw me as I was way back then, broken, no confidence, no self-esteem, no self-love or self-worth. He saw the old me and he'd seen the transformation happen. He's seen me spread my wings and find my voice, and he's all for you go do what you feel is right. And he said that money and those 4 years of training is not a waste. Just look at you, Amp. He calls me Amp, just look at you. It's not a waste of money. So yeah, he just enabled me to go do what I do now, which is lots of talking. Raising awareness.
Amazing. And so how can people find you? So you're on Instagram.
Yes, I'm on Instagram. It's Restore the Gears or Redhead Biker Chick. Out of a bottle, but Redhead Biker Chick. I'm on Facebook, author and advocate for the silence. So Anthony McCartan, author and advocate for the silence. That's my Facebook page. And Anthony McCartan on LinkedIn.
Okay, good. Good. So we'll put all those links anyway below so people can come and find you.
Yeah.
Oh, Anthea, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. It really has. Yeah.
Yeah. And, such useful, relevant, valuable information that you've shared today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So that's all for today's episode of Bulimia Sucks. So thank you to everybody for listening. And before we go, make sure that you subscribe to the podcast on Apple iTunes so you never miss an episode. And then let us know what you think and show some love, your favorite podcast, by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. So thank you to everybody for listening. And I look forward to speaking with you in the next episode.
Bulimia Sucks. But you don't. Kate has just released a new best-selling book called Anxiety Hacks, with proven techniques, tools, and tips to calmness. Check it out now on Amazon.